cable committee. The committee was recently formed to celebrate the many achievements and contributions of our fellow McGillians and encourage faculty and staff and retirees to participate in campus community events. Amira Turk is the manager, but she couldn't be here with us. Though Joan Dealey is on the retirees committee. I'm sure he could answer some questions if you had any. And the campus community also has a McGill webpage if you're interested in learning more about their events. So also I have circulated some James McGill Society membership forms. If you're not already a member of the society, we'd be delighted to see you join in our meetings. And also, this is a special meeting because we're celebrating the 190th anniversary of McGill. It's a very special milestone year, and we certainly have come a long way since the university was officially founded in 1821, the result of a generous bequest from James McGill. And our speakers tonight will tell us about the dedication and commitment of some of the people who have truly helped to shape the course of McGill's history. And speaking of celebrating milestones, there is someone here who has just celebrated a milestone birthday. So please join me in extending best wishes to our good friend on the occasion of his 99th birthday, Dr. Stanley Frost. I'd like to call on John Hobbins. John is a McGill graduate, a member of the James McGill Society Executive Committee, a former law librarian and associate director of libraries. In recognition of his many years of work and service, he is a recipient of the library's Career Recognition Award. And since his retirement in the library, John has resumed his research on the history of the Faculty of Law. So hopefully we'll be having a paper very shortly on the history of the Faculty of Law. Ladies and gentlemen, John Hobbins.
Thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure, of course, but it's also a privilege to introduce our speakers today. I'll do them in the order that they're speaking. I've known Peter McNally for a long time. A proud resident of Tillsonburg, Ontario, he graduated, I believe, in Canadian history from the University of Western Ontario, and then came to Library School at McGill. He once told me that the two best decisions he made in his life were to come to Library School in 1964 and to stay in Montreal in 1966 when he graduated. I didn't actually meet him until the spring of 1967 when he was in his first year as a reference librarian in the Redpath Library. This was before McLennan had been built, and I was a sort of intern. Since I was only the other male in a department full of females, Peter took me over and put me under his wing. In my first month, he made me go and complain to the director of libraries about the dress code for male librarians, which was not a good career move, as it turned out. And shortly thereafter, recognized me as an immigrant straight off the boat who didn't know things. He took me to my first, and I assure you, my only bridal shower. It took a number of years of therapy to get over that, and still more years for me to come to the conclusion that the decision he made to stay in Montreal was indeed a good one. Shortly thereafter, moved to acquisitions, and after a brief period there, went to his favorite library job as librarian of the Lawrence M. Landy Foundation for Canadian Historical Research. There he was able to combine his love for Canadiana, for rare books, and for Canadian history. But nonetheless, within a few years, Library School called, and he changed careers and became what he calls a library educator. He rose in the ranks from assistant professor to associate professor and finally to full professor. And his published works were then generally on the history of books and printing and on Canadian public libraries. Then, because the law was different, Stanley Frost took compulsory retirement and wasn't quite ready to give up then, and became the first director of the History of McGill Project, charged with producing a monographic history of the institution. As a sort of side benefit of this, he also started the James McGill Society, one of our sponsors tonight.
Yeah.
Oh, good. I thought you said something else for a minute. And almost from the beginning, Peter McNally was there with Stanley, helping him on these projects, and eventually, maybe a generation or more later, Stanley, having produced two books on the history of McGill, a couple of biographies on James McGill and Principal James and many articles, decided to rest a bit, and Peter inherited the mantle, becoming the director of the History of McGill Project, charged with volume three of the history. Nowadays, Peter, the media seek him out to talk about the royal family, especially when they get married or divorced, and they seem to do a lot of that. In 2002, he was awarded the Queen's Golden Jubilee Medal, whatever that is. Now, that was 10 years ago, so maybe there's a Diamond Medal, Jubilee Medal, coming up this year, I don't know. More recently, and I felt this was more important, his scholarship was recognised when the Bibliographic Society of Canada presented him with the Marie Tremaine Medal for outstanding service to Canadian bibliography and for distinguished publications. Someone's been drinking, I think. Yes, okay. Turning to our second speaker, I've not known Chris Lyons for quite so long. Now, library degrees usually come 2 years after the undergraduate degree, but Chris has had an atypical educational pattern. He was BA 1989, DIP Ed 94, MA 2002, before finally seeing the light and going to get his library degree in 2004. His CV doesn't relate what he was doing in that time, but he might not have liked it so much. I don't know. Perhaps he'll tell us. After graduation, he joined the staff of the Osa Library, where he worked as rare book librarian. And this involved reference service, instruction, collection building, and digitization projects. He was recently promoted to associate librarian with tenure, which is harder than when I got it and Peter did. He is now the interim head of the Osa Library. He has published on the Osa Library, Kel Surprise, and as well as library history and Canadian medical history. He's the incoming president of the Archivists and Librarians in the History of Health Sciences. I looked it up. It's an international, highly specialized organization. And he's the communications secretary of the James McGill Society. So if you got invited here, it was probably Chris. And he's a member of the Campus Community Committee, our other sponsor, as am I, which wasn't mentioned. Finally, Chris is the chair of the McGill Ecumenical Chaplaincy Support Committee. So without further ado, I will introduce you to our two speakers, Peter McNally and Christopher Lyons.
Thank you very much, John, for that wonderful introduction, as usual. It was colorful, and but now that you've done it and you all see that I own a jacket, I'll take off my jacket if that's perfectly all right. I find that when I talk, I generate a fair amount of body heat, and besides which I find this is a rather a warm room. I'll even undo my tie, but that's as far as it will go. It's wonderful to see all these friendly faces, both familiar faces and new faces. As John has mentioned, of course, I've been here quite a while, and we're here, I guess, really to talk about the past As John mentioned, I came from a small Ontario town of about 5,000 people. And of course, one of the comments that would be made from time to time about people is, quote, they have a past. And that was all that was needed to be said. You knew that there was trouble, and of one sort or another, and there was a juicy story which might or might not be told. Well, I'm beginning with the assumption tonight that McGill University has a past. And although this is not going to be the National Enquirer version, I think that what we're going to try to do, Chris Lyons and I, is to give a bit of a flavor of what this past is all about. It does have some juicy elements, but it also, I think, does have some rather substantive issues. One of the things which motivated this was the fact that for the university's 190th anniversary, we were able to bring out a special theme issue of the McGill Reporter on the history of the university. And I think that this was seen as an opportunity to remind people, to make new, to bring fresh again, the fact that our university does, in fact, have a very important tradition that we need to be reminded of. I think part of the strength of McGill is the fact that, unlike the Bourbon family of France, of whom it was said they forgot nothing and they learned nothing, at McGill I would like to think that we remember, but we learn also from our past. This is what Chris and I are involved in, and certainly we like to feel that we're following upon Stanley Frost's pattern in taking this approach. I'm going to give a brief overview. Chris will do a case study of the Faculty of Medicine. There are many faculties which, of course, one could talk about, but he's going to emphasize the Faculty of Medicine. First of all, it's the oldest faculty at McGill, and for people outside the university, it's possibly the best-known faculty. In my case, I'm going to take a look at some of the leading 19th century figures, and I'm going to develop my theme around the same theme that we used in the McGill Reporter, and this is the idea of builders, benefactors, and scholars. But before I get into this, I think a little bit of background, and I think we have to begin with the assumption and the acceptance of the fact that over its 190 years, McGill has gone through some difficult and painful eras, and that the birth of McGill 190 years ago was not an easy thing. McGill was founded in obscurity, and it grew from obscurity to become a major university with an international reputation. And how did this happen? Well, I would suggest to you that this happened because of a number of factors, two of which are really quite crucial. The first one is that when McGill was founded in 1821, 191 years ago, in the early 19th century, Montreal was already by that time the dominant Canadian city. But it was a trading and commercial city. It was only later in the 19th century that Montreal would emerge as an industrial city in the 1850s and 60s the Industrial Revolution began in Canada. In the late 19th century, after Confederation, of course, Montreal emerged as the economic, the transportation, and the cultural center of Canada, and we became a transcontinental nation in the late 19th century, with Montreal basically as the economic, transportation, and cultural center of the country. And I think that this transition of Montreal from just being a commercial city to an industrial city, to being the center of a transcontinental nation, is absolutely essential to understanding how McGill emerged the way it has. The second aspect of understanding Montreal and McGill University and how McGill fits in is appreciating the fact that the university has had grown around it. First of all, the center of Montreal. At our next meeting of the James McGill Society, we're going to have Professor David Colvo talking about the development of McGill College Avenue. And in the past, we have had Professor Derek Drummond speak about how downtown Montreal grew around McGill University. But from, and that's important from McGill's perspective, but another important aspect is the fact that we are the anchor for the square mile where the Anglophone elite of the late 19th and early 20th century lived, where 75% of Canadian wealth was centered in the pre-World War I era. And up until the 1970s, of course, Montreal was also Canada's largest city, and today it remains a major Canadian center, and of course the metropolis for the province of Quebec. The commitment to support McGill by the local Anglophone community was absolutely essential through the 19th century. And so therefore, I think what we say is that as we see the transition of Canadian higher education from the early 19th century through the middle to the late 19th century, McGill plays a central role in understanding how this happens. Well, what am I getting at? Well, on the eve of Confederation, 1860, there were only 1,000 university students enrolled in Canadian universities. In early 19th century Canada, higher education was such a low priority, it hardly shows up at all on the screen. By the end of the 19th century, higher education in Canada emerges as something of importance. And I think that the role of McGill University in making sure, of course, that this happened was essential. It was a slow thing that occurred, but I think it was a crucial event. So there we are. So in talking about the development and history of McGill and its great leaders, its benefactors, its builders, and its scholars, the first person we begin with, of course, is James McGill himself. Now, the official beginning date, as John Hobbins mentioned, and Susan Button as well, is the 1821 Royal Charter from George IV. But I would suggest to you that the beginnings of McGill can really be said to start in 1744. And this is the birth date of James McGill himself. He attended the University of Glasgow in Scotland. Before coming to Montreal, he came right at the beginning of the British regime, approximately 1766. He very quickly became a well-to-do citizen in the early years of the British regime in Montreal. He was prosperous. He made money in the fur trade as a general merchant. He got involved with politics. He became a magistrate. He became a leader of the Montreal militia. He was one of the central people in the development of Montreal as a trading and commercial center. He, of course, had a townhouse and a country estate. And that country estate, oh yes, well, let's take a look at this verse. These are his Beaver Club medals, and they were given to people who had actually traded in the Upper Northland country. And I think that we have them here at McGill as part of the university's collections. I think they're at the McCord Museum. But I think they're indicative of just how central a role he played in this development. This would appear to have been his townhouse, Notre Dame Street, with his warehouse. It was torn down in the 1930s, I believe, to make way for, or rather, fetching garage for City Hall. But I guess not everything will survive. From our perspective, this is the important building. This is the Burnside Estate, and this was his house. I gather that it was probably just below Sherbrooke Street along McGill College, getting towards the area of President Kennedy Avenue. It disappeared, of course, quite some time ago. James McGill died in 1813. He left a bequest of £10,000. This country estate, Burnside, place nestled here on the slopes of Mount Royal. And his will specified that there was to be a college founded within 10 years bearing his name. And in 1821, there was the Royal Charter. 1829, teaching begins in the Faculty of Medicine. McGill, I would suggest to you, has depended during its history for support and direction from wealthy benefactors, visionary administrators, creative scholars and academics. And amongst these wealthy benefactors, James McGill, of course, remains as the first, and I would suggest to you the most important one from our point of view. Why was this so important in the 19th century? Well, the reason for this, of course, is because government funding was virtually unknown for McGill during the 19th century. From time to time, we would get small amounts of money, but we only began receiving regular provincial grants in 1911, 1912, and this was $3,000 for teacher training. I should add, in that same year, the University of Toronto received $1 million from the Ontario government. And so, therefore, if McGill hadn't received private money, it simply would never have been able to have been able to continue. In 1962, major government funding started coming, and so that's only about 40 years now. And so 40 years out of 190 years, how else would we have managed if it hadn't been for private money? The next important person from our perspective and I guess it's our fifth principal, Sir John William Dawson. He was born in 1820. He died in 1899. He was principal. He's our longest serving principal from 1855 to 1893. He was the leading Canadian scientist of his day. He's considered by many people to have been McGill's greatest principal. Certainly, he is the principal who established McGill. And until Sir William Dawson came along, McGill, frankly, wasn't doing much of anything. In fact, when he arrived in 1855, there were only 66 students at McGill. We weren't even large enough to be considered obscure. We were virtually invisible. And it was Dawson that I think really made the difference. But Dawson, on top of everything else, had timing on his side. 1855, this is the decade when Montreal becomes a leading industrial city. When you had Red Pass Sugar and along the banks of the Lachine Canal and other factories and industries developing, and when Montreal moves forward economically to become the powerhouse of the Canadian economy. Dawson's arrival coinciding exactly with this put him in a position to be able to connect with these great captains of industry. Now, of course, in Canada, we didn't call them captains of industry. In the United States, of course, they were called robber barons. In Canada, we referred to them as merchant princes. And the trick was to get as many of them as possible on the McGill Board of Governors. And that's where Dawson greatly succeeded. He was a prolific author. He was a scientist, the Natural History Society. He published 10 to 12 books and articles per year. He was involved with the Montreal Natural History Society and its museum. Much of its material ended up eventually coming here to McGill. He was also the leading anti-Darwinian of his day. Teaching and work had been had moved off the campus. He brought it back onto the campus. He opened the Normal School, the precursor of the Faculty of Education, and this is where female education for Anglophone women in Montreal began. Under him, the enrollment increased, but the enrollment under him was primarily was entirely for men, at least to begin with. This, of course, is what the campus looked like And he's important as well because he there's Burnside Hall where the normal school was. And there's another picture of the normal school. And this was the graduating class of 1866. And you can see, composed entirely of men. So he brought in science and engineering, sports, physical education were certainly part of the life of the campus. He did fundraising, and he attracted the Anglophone elite. And there were two families in particular, the Molsons and the Redpaths. Unlike some universities, McGill has never been fearful of attracting beer money. And this is, I should add, as John mentioned, I attended the University of Western Ontario, which refused resolutely to take any money from the Labatt family because they would not have a Labatt Hall on the campus. McGill has never had such scruples, and I'm sure we're all better for it. Here we can see the international football match, Harvard versus McGill. It was really quite something. William Molson, one of the great benefactors, and of course he built the Molsons built the west wing of the Arts Building and the connecting wings between the Arts Building, the center block, and over to what we now call Dawson Hall. Donald Smith, Lord Strathcona. He was one of the great benefactors, but one of the things he did, of course, was to establish the teaching of women. And the Donaldas, the first women students, were as a result of his benefactions. The Redpaths, Peter and Grace Redpath, they built Redpath Museum, where we are today, and Redpath Library, Redpath Hall. Women benefactors emerged at this period as well, too. And by 1882, McGill had become Canada's leading university. There's Smith looking rather fearsome, I would say, in there. And here's a picture of the Donaldas. This is 1888, this is the first class of these women students. There was female education in Canadian universities before this, but we are still considered to be at the vanguard. Here are Grace and Peter Redpath, the benefactors of this museum where we are this evening. And remember, this was the first specifically designed museum building in Canada, and Redpath Library was the first specifically designed library building in Quebec, and the second university library building in the country. The Redpath Museum in 1884, and this was the inside of Redpath Library. It's still the reading room, of course, today is where so many events occur, but it remains as majestic as ever. And this just gives you a flavor of the development. And this is a picture of Dawson by the time he retires. And if you ever needed a good reason not to remain principal of McGill University for 40 years, I would say that this picture is as good a reason as any, really. That brings us, I guess, to our next major figure, and this is Sir William Peterson. And again, he's another great, he was both a scholar and, I guess, a builder. He was a great principal, but he also was a great classical scholar. He was Scottish, and under him, the solidification of McGill's reputation as a great international university occurs. But remember, by the time he arrives in 1895, Montreal, as I said, really was the capital of a transcontinental nation in all but name. Yes, Ottawa was the political capital, but Montreal culturally and certainly economically was. As I said, 75% of the Canadian wealth was considered to be centralized in the square mile. And from an economic point of view, remember, during the age of Laurier, the late 19th, early 20th century, the pre-World War I era, the economic growth of Canada was amongst the greatest in the world. The Canadian economy leaped ahead by at a great pace. And under Peterson, who I might add was not a particularly easy person to deal with, the students disliked him. He never really seemed at home in Canada. In the spring, he would catch the first at the end of term, the first liner across the Atlantic back to Britain. In the fall, he would wait as long as possible before taking a return liner back to Montreal. He was here, but he always made it clear he'd rather be somewhere else. However, that did not prevent him from being an outstanding principal. And why was this? Well, he certainly had great concern about the academic development of the university. Under him, the School of Graduate Studies was founded, the first granting of PhDs, and McGill made the great leap forward to becoming a research university. And in fact, along with the University of Toronto, we are the first examples of Canadian research universities. But what really made the difference for Peterson and why his principalship was so very successful was because of his ability to attract, again, outstanding benefactors. Now, Lord Strathcona still continued, and particularly with the support of female education, he built Royal Victoria College for Women. He also builds the new medical building, which is just up at the corner of Pine and University, now the Strathcona Medical Building. But the other person whom he attracted was Sir William MacDonald. And Sir William MacDonald was the greatest university benefactor of his time. And in fact, when he was knighted by Queen Victoria, this was the citation from the Queen. He was being the greatest university benefactor. And it was extraordinary what he did. He was a bachelor. He never married. He was from Prince Edward Island. He was intelligent, not particularly educated. And I should add that of the early benefactors of McGill, Redpath, Molson, Strathcona, MacDonald, none of them was particularly well educated. None of them ever attended university. And it does pose the question, why did these men, and women too, I might add, in the case of Mrs. Redpath, Grace Redpath, what is it that prompted these people who were intelligent enough, but they were certainly not educated, they weren't university people, but yet they still gave these immense fortunes that permitted this university to move forward? I think it's a fascinating question. And the answer that I would come up with immediately was that they believed in McGill, they understood the importance of education, they knew that it was a good that needed to be supported for its own sake, but also for the sake of society, and that this was something that with which they wanted to be associated. This was MacDonald as a young man. He lived just on Sherbrooke Street at the corner of McTavish and Prince of Wales Terrace, where the Brofman Management Building now stands. These are Smith and Strathcona in old age. MacDonald built, of course, MacDonald College out in St. Anne de Bellevue, two engineering buildings, the first one burnt down, the physics building, the chemistry building, and he not only did he build them, he also furnished them, he supplied them with equipment, and he provided these remarkable endowments. By his death in 1917, and I guess the bequest that came at his death, McGill received something in the neighborhood of about $15 million. Now, taking those those World War I, pre-World War I dollars, and translating them into values 100 years later in the year 2012, it's it's impossible to make an exact calculation, but one would have to say that they were worth in the neighborhood of several hundreds of billions of dollars. It would have been, I would say, a minimum of $500 million in today's money that he put into developing McGill. And one of the things, of course, that he did, and you can see this enormous emphasis, engineering, chemistry, physics, the ability of benefactors to determine the direction of the university. Here's Royal Victoria College, there's McDonald College, McDonald Engineering Building, the McDonald Physics Building, McDonald Chemistry is another one. Those buildings, of course, are the chemistry and the physics buildings, of course, still stand today, although they have different uses for them. But as a result of all these benefactions, there was somebody who was attracted to this university. This was a New Zealander by the name of Ernest Rutherford. And Ernest Rutherford was only at McGill for a relatively short period of time, but he, along with Frederick Soddy, they undertook this remarkable research which demanded a combination of both physics and chemistry together. And they played a crucial role in the development of the atomic age. The atomic age came to McGill, and I guess you could say McGill helped bring about the atomic age. And as a result, in 1908, Rutherford received a Nobel Prize, and in 1921, Frederick Soddy received one as well. And it was for the research that was done here at McGill. This is an extraordinary accomplishment. And when you think about it, that Frederick Soddy received his Nobel Prize in 1921, exactly 100 years after McGill received its royal charter. From going from obscurity, from what wasn't much more than a small town in 1821, to being the economic, transportation, cultural center of a transcontinental nation 100 years later, that had a major university that was able to produce scientific work that would win a Nobel Prize, I would say is a remarkable accomplishment. Therefore, I begin with what I said initially. McGill has a past, and it's a past which has had its ups and its downs. It has its strengths and its weaknesses, but I think it's a past which is worth celebrating with the 190th anniversary. And with that, I would like to turn the microphone over to my colleague, Chris Lyon, and for him to continue.
Thank you.
Feel like I'm packing heat.
Yes, you are.
Great. Did you just take my speech, Peter? I could improvise. Or are you trying to tell me something? All right, everyone, go home. Peter's telling me it's over. It's over. I can take hints. Well, like McGill, and like, as John alluded to, I too have a past as well, although probably anything you can imagine is far more interesting than anything I actually did or got up to. I'm Chris Lyons. I'm from the Ulster Library of the History of Medicine. I want to thank you all for being here. It's very kind of you to come out. I'm particularly delighted to see a family here, and I think it's wonderful because I think there's nothing better you can do than to generate a love of learning in your children. So thank you so much, and a particular welcome to you too. I'd like to say hello to everyone who's watching online now or in the future and say, hi, Mom. I promised you I would, and I did. And I also like to say, again, happy birthday to Dr. Frost. It's wonderful to have you here with us today. And I would also like to express my gratitude to Mira Tech and the McGill Campus Community Committee for co-sponsoring this event, and to just compliment Peter and John on their wonderful taste in ties. Now, for my talk, I want to give you a flavor of McGill's, the thing around our necks. Yeah, they're called ties. Give you a flavor of McGill's history by using medicine as a case study for our theme, drawing on material from the Osler Library's collection. I'll be looking specifically at three people who represent our themes of benefactors, scholars, and builders, namely Sir William Osler, benefactor of the Osler Library, Dr. Maud Abbott, a scholar in the field of cardiology and museum curatorship, and Dr. Wilder Penfield, the builder of the world-famous Montreal Neurological Institute. I'd like to start with Sir William Osler, one of Canada, if not the world's, most famous medical luminaries, whose gift of approximately 8,000 historical books in medicine and science to McGill in 1919 established the Osler Library. Like Peter, born outside Toronto in Ontario in 1849, Osler studied medicine at Toronto and at McGill, graduating in 1872. There followed 2 years of postgraduate studies in Europe before returning to McGill in 1874 to teach internal medicine at the ripe old age of 25. He was called the baby professor by his friends, where he introduced a number of innovations. After 10 years at McGill, the rising star in medicine did what many Canadian rising stars, past and present, do. He moved to the United States. He spent 5 years at the University of Pennsylvania before moving on in 1889 to help found that experiment in medical excellence, the Johns Hopkins Medical School and Hospital in Baltimore. Finally, from 1905 until his death in 1919, he was Regius Professor of Medicine at Oxford, where he was knighted for his work in 1911. Osler is remembered for a number of reasons. His talks and essays on medicine as a noble calling have been inspirational. His publications are considered classics of medical scholarship and erudite writing, and his kindness and wisdom as a physician and professor were fondly attested to by thousands of grateful patients, students, and colleagues. What I wish to present to you, though, is Osler the bibliophile, or more accurately, Osler the bibliomaniac, although, albeit, a rather gentle-looking maniac, a man who once confessed to a group of antiquarian booksellers that you see before you a mental, moral, almost, I may say, a physical wreck, and all of your making. Until I became mixed up with you, I was really a respectable, God-fearing, industrious, ardent, enthusiastic, energetic student. Now what am I? A mental wreck, devoted to nothing but your literature, meaning catalogs of books for sale. Instead of attending to my duties and attending to my work, in comes every day by the post, and by every post, all this seductive literature with which you have, as you will know perfectly well, gradually undermined the mental virility of many a better man than I. Osler's mission, or perhaps obsession, was to create a collection of the great works in medicine and to a lesser extent science from the Assyrians, for example, this clay tablet, to the most recent advances in medicine in Osler's own day. Osler's library had a special meaning for him, for beyond the goal of having a historical collection was a desire to go deeper into, and I quote, the lives of the great men of the profession, to be in sympathetic touch with those friends of the spirit, the great and good men of the past, who, through much tribulation, handed on the torch to our generation. End of quote. In other words, Osler believed in the power of role models, which is fitting, seeing as he's been the role model par excellence for generations of people in the medical field. Collecting at a time when books were perhaps more plentiful and most definitely cheaper in absolute terms than today, Osler was able to amass an impressive collection. The Assyrian clay tablet was joined by several medieval manuscripts from both Europe and the Middle East, such as the unique 13th century herbal of El-Ghafiqi. Osler also collected the great works of medicine and science of the Renaissance and beyond. such as the wonderfully illustrated 1543 Anatomical Atlas de Fabrica by Andreas Vesalius, which overturned a millennium of thinking in this field. And that other great groundbreaking work of that year, 1543, Copernicus's treatise on the heliocentric solar system. By the way, the Osler Library is the only library in Canada with a copy of this edition of this work.
Could you speak a little louder, please?
I'll try my best. Do we have a microphone here? Or there should be a microphone. This one? Okay. It doesn't move. Does this one actually? This one doesn't project. Dr. Frost, it's over here. So what I'm going to do is just try and speak louder and tell me if it's, is this okay? As a volume? All right. Okay. I'll try and project or bellow. Okay, I apologize. Osler left his wonderful library to McGill University out of a sense of gratitude to his alma mater for having given him a start in medicine and out of patriotism. A library to house it was specially designed in the Faculty of Medicine Strathcona building by Piercy Knobs, a building you know a bit about thanks to Professor McNally, a noted Montreal architect and McGill professor. He designed it to be simple yet graceful and dignified, using oak for the paneling and the bookcases. The library's focal point is the Osler niche, with its large bronze plaque of Sir William and where his and Lady Osler's ashes were placed. Osler once wrote, "I like to think of my few books in an alcove of a fireproof library, in some institution that I love. At the end of the alcove, an open fireplace and a few easy chairs. And over the mantelpiece, an urn with my ashes and my bust or my portrait, through which my astral self can peek at the books I have loved and enjoy the delight with which kindred souls still in the flesh would handle them." Thanks to Sir William, the Osler Library is one of the great history of medicine libraries in the world, with a collection of 100,000 rare books and secondary works on the history of medicine, as well as over 150 different archival collections, several thousand prints and photographs, and hundreds of artifacts. The Oslerian enthusiasm for collecting and sharing continues to this day as the library serves students and researchers from all over the world. Now, one of the most popular archival collections at the Osler Library is that of Dr. Maud Abbott. Her story is one of indomitable will and enthusiasm in the face of almost insurmountable odds. Abandoned by her father at birth, orphaned by her mother's death when she was 7 months old, Maud Abbott was raised by her maternal grandmother. She entered McGill's arts program in 1886, only 2 years after women were admitted to the university. She later wrote that amongst the 9 women in her year, she, quote, "fell our new advantage most acutely of all. I was literally in love with McGill," or so the girl said, "and I have never really fallen out of love with her since." For much of the rest of her life, however, that love was pretty much unrequited, beginning with her application to medical school in 1890. Despite considerable pressure to admit her and other females, it would be 28 more years before the first female medical students appeared on campus. Instead, Maud studied at Bishop's University and did postgraduate work in Europe. She managed to breach the ramparts of McGill's Faculty of Medicine, however, in 1898 by being named assistant curator of the Medical Museum. I should explain that museums of specimens played a critical role in medical education and research in the 19th century and early 20th century. In the days before CAT scans, MRIs, and ultrasounds, doing dissections and studying specimens preserved in jars were perhaps the best ways for students and researchers to understand the internal characteristics of diseases, wounds, and abnormalities. When Dr. Abbott was hired, the McGill Medical Museum was disorganized and almost useless as a teaching and research tool. Dr. George Adami, the head of pathology and director of the museum, sent her to the States to study museum organization. During this trip, she met William Osler, then at Johns Hopkins, and a relationship developed in which he acted as her mentor and supporter, as he did for so many others. His enthusiasm for medical museums inspired her to an extent that had a profound impact on McGill and beyond. In the course of her tenure as curator, Dr. Abbott developed a sophisticated classification system that was adopted by a number of other museums and which continues to be studied today. She also developed the museum as a center for pathological instruction. At first, she gave ad hoc demonstrations to students who dropped in, but these grew to be so popular and appreciated that a formalized course of instruction became compulsory. Her museum-related work also had international implications on the wider field of pathology. In 1906, she was the driving force behind the establishment of the International Association of Medical Museums, whose journal she also edited. Because of the critical importance of medical museums to pathology, the organization attracted pathologists from Canada, the United States, Europe, and elsewhere. In fact, it became the International Association of Pathologists, the largest pathological organization in the world. Her research on congenital heart disease also had an international impact. Her entry on the topic for William Osler's multi-volume system of medicine was more than he expected, to say the least. He wrote to her that, "I knew you would write a good article, but I did not expect one of such extraordinary merit. It is by far and away the very best thing ever written on the subject in English, possibly in any language. For years, it will be the standard work on the subject. Many, many thanks." This letter was so meaningful to Dr. Abbott that she had it framed, as you can see. And it now rests in the Osler Library, and you can come and see it whenever you want. So she continued in this work of congenital heart disease for the rest of her life. The success which greeted her exhibition on the subject in the 1932 meeting of the British Medical Association encouraged her to write the Atlas of Congenital Cardiac Disease in 1936, which was the last word in the field for many years. Recognition of her place in cardiology came from many corners. One of the most noteworthy might be something you even recognize, or at least the artist. This is a wall mural of 50 historically important cardiologists created by Mexican artist Diego Rivera for his country's Institute of Cardiology. Can you find her in there? If you look carefully, there's only a couple of women in here. And she is right there, right at the upper left, yeah. Finally, I would like to introduce Wilder Penfield in his capacity as a builder. Wilder Penfield is known to many, if for no other reason than because of the subject of a Heritage Minute on television, the sort of infamous "I Smell Toast" ad, or because McGregor Street was named in his honor. This memorialization is well-founded given his vision and drive, which led to the founding of the Montreal Neurological Institute and Hospital in 1934. The Osler Library is a proud repository for the Wilder Penfield Archive, a collection of 80 meters of print material, including research notes, correspondence, and diaries, as well as photographs and glass slides that cover the whole span of his long professional and personal life. Many of the images I used in this part of the presentation come from this archive. Born on January 26, 1891, in Spokane, Washington, I think it's safe to call Wilder Penfield a driven man. As an undergraduate at Princeton, he won a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford, where he studied medicine. At Oxford, Penfield was befriended, like many other students, by Sir William Osler, whom for Penfield, as for many others, exemplified the great physician who was profoundly knowledgeable and who truly loved and cared for his patients. His second role model was that of pioneering neurophysiologist Sir Charles Sherrington, who embodied the great scientist and who inspired Penfield to make neurology his life work. Penfield later wrote, "I looked through his eyes and came to realize that here in the nervous system was the great unexplored field, the undiscovered country, in which the mystery of the mind of man might someday be explained." Penfield was also fascinated by surgery, particularly neurosurgery, to which he was exposed while at Boston in 1918-19, at the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital, working with the great founder of modern neurosurgery and yet another friend of Osler's, Harvey Cushing. Whoops. There he is. Harvey Cushing's the man with the bow tie, and Wilder Penfield's up there. Harvey Cushing is the subject of Michael Bliss's, I think, latest biography. It followed the Osler biography, and Harvey Cushing's a fascinating character. He's much more complex and multidimensional, and not as nice a man as Osler. So he makes a fascinating read. Penfield also realized that the best way to advance neurosurgery was for the surgeon to also be a neurologist. In other words, to be able to research problems and conditions and then diagnose and operate on them. In 1922, he wrote to his mother that the best way to evolve the field would be to create, I quote, a neurological institute, including surgery. It is along that line that the real future of neurology lies. Penfield was lured to Montreal in 1928 by Dr. Edward Archibald, a thoracic and neurosurgeon at the Royal Victoria Hospital, who felt that Montreal needed a full-time neurosurgeon. Penfield was named Surgeon-in-Chief of Neurosurgery at the Royal Vic and Professor of Neurological Surgery at McGill. A small neuropathology lab was also established, headed by his close friend from New York, Dr. William Cohn. Penfield's impatient desire to create his ideal institute was articulated within 5 months of his arrival at McGill. Writing to Archibald in January 1929, Penfield proposed creating an institute with a 40-bed hospital and 17 laboratories in a building attached to the Royal Victoria Hospital. He included a sketch of the proposed institute. Like a good Presbyterian, he didn't use his own newspaper. He used some hotel stationery, the Biltmores. He included a sketch of the proposed institute and estimates of the cost. He secured a grant for over $1 million in 1931 from the Rockefeller Foundation. But this was contingent upon McGill and others providing the remaining funds needed to build and operate the institute. There was considerable pressure on McGill to act despite being in the midst of the Great Depression, as the University of Pennsylvania had promised to fund Penfield's dream if he only moved there. McGill came through, however, with the university, and the university was awarded the grant in 1931. As plans developed, however, the costs ran over and the depression worsened. Some things never change. One day, Penfield was called into the office of McGill's principal, Sir Arthur Currie. An imposing man, a former commander of the Canadian Corps in the First World War, Currie revealed modified plans for the institute in which 2 of the 8.5 floors were removed. He informed Penfield that we must cut the coat to fit the cloth, to which Penfield angrily responded that no one wants such a coat. Calming down, he then argued that the institute could pay its own way on the basis of its good work and renown. To this, Currie pounded his fist on the desk and shouted, "Damn it! They told me you would say just that. Well, I've made up my mind what I would say in case you did. We can't go on without you, whether we like it or not. The university will have to take a chance that you know what you're talking about, and that you and Cohn and Russell and the others can run your own show and keep us out of debt after the building is built." The building, all 8.5 stories of it, was officially opened on September 27, 1934. Wilder Penfield's dream of bringing surgeons and scientists together under one roof, dedicated to relief of sickness and pain and the study of neurology, as inscribed in the building's facade, was indeed a reality. I'd just like to conclude my talk by inviting you to the Osler Library. We have, as I mentioned, a large collection of material in the history of medicine, the history of science, including archival material. And we also have exhibitions that are publicly accessible. Currently, we have one on medical prints, historical medical prints. And for more information about our collections, or if you'd like to arrange a visit, please feel free to contact me. Thank you.
Happy to answer any questions, if there's any questions.
Get this off.
Oh? All right, then. Yes?
Can I ask Peter a question?
Of course.
Sure. Peter, you were born in Tilsonburg, right?
Well, yes.
is that a tobacco growing town?
Oh, yes, it's definitely tobacco country.
So the Sin Corporation, you immediately said it's okay to accept all the money you could because you were a tobacco farmer.
That's right. I have no objections to McGill receiving money either from tobacco or from alcohol. And I think that it was all given in a very, very good cause. Absolutely. Yes.
This gentleman here?
McGill, or the medical school, was originally was a separate school. When did it become part of McGill?
In 1829. Now, I tell the story slightly differently. You can probably correct it. But, of course, what we like to tell ourselves up the hill is that McGill, I guess the Board of Governors that existed in the 1820s, were desperate to actually get the university up and running, because I think that there was a time limit to when the money would revert back to the estate, if I'm not mistaken. And then, well, this is what we tell ourselves anyway. These are called foundation myths, and they get us very far. And, of course, the Montreal Medical Institutions had been founded in the Montreal General Hospital in, I believe it's 1821, which was not uncommon for, especially British, medical education to be embedded in a hospital as opposed to on a university campus. So it had already existed, and so what happened was, in order to become an instant university with students, that independent medical school became the Faculty of Medicine of the university.
Now the university.
The real story.
Now, the other story is, the alternative interpretation is that the medical school in the hospital wanted to be able to give degrees. And so they applied to get a charter, and the province said, no, we're not going to give a charter just to a medical school, we only give them to universities. And so therefore, in order to be respectable, they looked around, and McGill was there waiting. And so McGill did this great favor to this medical school and permitted it to become its Faculty of Medicine.
So it depends on whose donors you're talking to.
So for anybody in fundraising, it's all a question of spin.
They have two.
Yes.
I read somewhere that back in 1907, the first engineering building that was built in money from William McDonald burnt down. And a few days later or a few days earlier, medical faculty.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Where was the medical faculty?
It's more or less in the place where the James Administration Building is, more or less in that area. And when I came to McGill in the 1960s, the back wing of it was still standing. And then it was eventually torn down, and it's that empty parking lot area in behind the James Building where it used to be. And so that was the only part that remained. And then the James Administration Building was put up after World War I, and that was originally biology. And then when the Stewart Biological Building opened in the mid-60s, then the James Building was converted into the Administration Building.
Apparently, if you look on the facade of the James Building, there's a frog, I believe.
Surmounting the McGill crest.
Yeah. And if you ever
Some
wonder
people
why...
Some think there's enormous symbolism.
But we don't tell our donors that.
Yes.
I just want to make a comment on the spirit of benefactors, and I think it's important to acknowledge Chris and Chris's predecessor, Pam Miller, who had a very big hand in working with a very recent benefactor to the Osler Library. As Chris will attest, it's not just about collecting materials, it's about making those materials accessible to people. And with Chris's work and Pam's work, the Osler Library received a very generous gift from a Dr. Granville Nickerson, Medicine 45, who actually we had the pleasure of hosting for a small event in the Osler Library last November. And Dr. Nickerson's gift is going to help support a scholar to do work in neurohistory, really the focus of which are the Penfield papers. So yeah. I think Chris needs to be credited for that also.
Thank you. No, we were very fortunate. We received $250,000 to establish an annual fellowship in the name of Mary Louise Nickerson. We began advertising it just actually today. And so if any of you are interested or know of anyone who is, if you go on the Australia website, you'll see all the details.
Any other questions?
Francis, did you have...
Well done, Chris. I wanted to ask you, do you know what happened to the artifacts in Maud Abbott's Medical Museum?
Some of them were kept, the Osler one amongst others. And like so many things, there's this period wherein something is of immediate scholarly interest. And then there's material which is of historical interest. Now between those two is this awkward adolescence where material is neither au courant or curious, and so it often gets tossed out. But thankfully there are champions of this material, and I'll recognize Dr. Richard Fraser in this regard, because he has managed to gather a great deal of these specimens and identified a number of them, and is in the process of creating the medical museum and arrange for proper storage and display of this material. But he's safeguarded them. So I can't say it's as extensive as you saw in the image, but notwithstanding, it is available, thankfully, and will be visible again. I think there was a question.
Did Krish have
just
something?
Above, did you have a question?
Go ahead. No? Krish?
Yes. Looking through the old photographs of the McDonald Engineering Building, the Nodron photographs, apparently there was an engineering museum on the fifth floor. Do you know anything about it? What happened to the engineering museum and where the artifacts are and why it disappeared?
No. Another mystery in the history of McGill for somebody to investigate. Was there another question?
What about the iron ring room? That's gone.
No. So you had a...
Will that be digitalized, the Maud Abbott Museum, like online?
There's an attempt, I think, and I don't know where it's at because I'm not involved with it directly, to digitize some of the artifacts anyway. And I don't know if that's going to be mounted or not. The ones that were in an exhibition that was held at the Osler a few years ago.
The links between England and Scotland, with Peterson, etc., were there joint degree programs or transfer of faculty members?
Between McGill and British universities?
Oxford, Cambridge.
No, there wasn't. But what McGill did, however, was it played a crucial role in the establishment of other universities. The University of British Columbia, the University of Victoria, and Victoria, British Columbia. It also played an important role in the development of other colleges and universities across the country.
Did James McGill come from a wealthy family?
No. No, he didn't. No, he was not. He did not come from a wealthy family, but by the standards of his day, being able to leave £10,000 towards establishing a university in 1813, that would have been immense fortune for the Canada of that day.
Yes.
Peter, could you say something about Maud Abbott or Chris and the faculty club? Because I think she was the first woman admitted to the faculty club or something like that.
Okay, I don't. There's the Maud Abbott room, of course.
When I was president of the club, we named it was the Ladies' Lounge, and it was decided that in honor of Maud Abbott, we should call it the Maud Abbott Room. I think that was done just about 30 years ago, in the early 1980s, and yes, in recognition. And of course, when I came to McGill, women were still not permitted to go into the ballroom at lunchtime, and they couldn't even eat in the main dining room. They had to eat in the gold room upstairs. And how they got around it was, as Professor Frances Bairstow of the School of Industrial Relations, she went up the main staircase. She walked through the main dining room, and you know, at the back there's a door and the staircase that goes down into the ballroom, because women weren't permitted to go through the main lounge. And so without stepping foot in the main lounge, she went down the back stairs and got into the ballroom, and that's how it got liberated. So when you hear about student occupation today, remember, occupation can take many different forms.
Okay. No, well, thank you. And now, to express the society's thanks, because we've heard about builders and benefactors, I'd like to call on a gentleman who really has an unwavering commitment to McGill for many years, our good friend Tom Thompson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm reassured to learn that the success of McGill University was never dependent on one leader. Rather, it has advanced its quality of teaching, research, and community service through faculty, staff, students, graduates, governors, and important friends of the university. This was the finding of our management guru, Henry Mintzberg, who did his research and found that the principal and the chancellor were really just the gatekeeper, and they were letting the right people in, we hope. And for many of us here this evening, we know of faculty and staff who do more than their assigned work or their day job in support of McGill. And our speakers this evening truly reflect this fact. But to acknowledge them on your behalf, and to be fair, I applaud them in alphabetical order. And I'm hoping this will not spark a student protest for our new administrative protocol. As well, I have to do this quickly. You see, recently, the president of the Union of French School Teachers complained that the report cards going out to all of the French-speaking Quebec students showed in their report, Anglais came before Français. The surprised spokesperson for the French school board said, it's alphabetical. So I'm going to do this quickly before the Quebec alphabet changes. And so to Chris Lyons, our Osler detective, your insights are a timely reminder of the exceptional doctor who made such a great contribution to McGill and society worldwide, and who, I'm pleased to find out, mentored two other exceptional doctors who made such a great impact on the world. And I remember when the story is told, because everyone here has a story, so I'm going to tell you my story. When Penfield was looking for that extra money, the mayor at the time was Mayor Hood, before he was put into the concentration camp on St. Helens Island. And Mayor Hood said, you're going to come in and you're going to speak to the council, but you don't say anything, I'll do it. And the vote will get the money from Montreal. So Penfield went in with him, sat down, and he said, this man is thinking of building a hospital where we can take our wives and even our lovers so close here, not having to go to the United States. And furthermore, when he was in Vancouver just 2 months ago, a lady couldn't see. He took her eyes out and washed them and put them back in, and it was perfect. Penfield said, I couldn't speak. I was dumbfounded. And they got their half a million dollars to help towards the project. So, Chris, thank you very much. And here, a little something. And my experience with alumni and people throughout North America has given me the feeling that there are three kinds of people. There are those who make things happen, those who watch things happen, and people like me who wonder, what happened? And so for someone who is going to make things happen for McGill and for that history of McGill that you followed so diligently from Dr. Frost, I would even say that Stanley Frost might say, we'll argue about this later, your alma mater, McGill, could not ask for a more loyal and competent son. Thank you very much on behalf of all of us.
Well, after that, all I need to say is thank you very much and look forward to hopefully seeing you all at the next meeting in April. Details will follow the David Cobo's talk about McGill College Avenue. Thank you again. Yeah.